You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
My friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, a lot of, a couple of BFDs here, as Joe Biden would say. Governor Brian Schweitzer of Montana, who has been on this program a number of times, has stepped up and asked the Obama administration, much like Peter Shumlin, the governor of Vermont, has asked, if those 2017 waivers when states can opt out of Obamacare, if he could get one right away, because he wants to institute in Montana a national or a statewide single-payer health care system, Medicare Part E. He wants to model it on Saskatchewan, a little up to the north of Montana. Saskatchewan, of course, the Canadian province that first did on their own. They didn't need a waiver from anybody. They just went ahead and did it on their own, a statewide single-payer health care system that covered everybody in the state out of basic just tax revenues. And it was so incredibly successful that province after province, I keep saying state, in Canada they're called provinces, but province after province across the nation of Canada, the Saskatchewan experience was replicated. I think this is fabulous. This is a big deal. This is really, really significant. Meanwhile, there is an occupation of Wall Street going on. I want to play a clip for you in just a moment that comes out of that. That is anonymous. So we did a piece yesterday. You know, yesterday we talked a lot about, you know, what if one of the hacktivist groups, now that we know that you can hack a voting machine with $28 worth of parts and eighth grade science knowledge, you know, what if Scooby-Doo became president? In fact, you can see a video asking that question over at DU, Democratic Underground, and TomHartman.com, and I'm not sure what other websites have picked it up and posted it. It's a good question, right? I mean, you know, hacktivists are sometimes pranksters as well. I remember a band back in the 60s, not a rock and roll band, a group, a political guerrilla theater band called the Merry Pranksters. So what if we held an election, say the Florida Republican primary, and Scooby-Doo gets elected as the Republican nominee? Stranger things are going to have happened. By the way, in the second hour of our program, we're going to be talking both with a fellow from the Reason Foundation and also with a reporter with the Minnesota Independent about what happens when you privatize prisons. What is this gung-ho John Kasich, Scott Walker, Rick Scott, Rick Snyder, on and on the list goes, right? You know, name your crackpot right-wing Republican governor. Paula Page in Maine, Chris Christie in New Jersey. What is it about these guys who think that selling off the commons, those things that have been administered by government literally since the revolution, so that they can plug a temporary budget hole in their state and get enough money to temporarily, you know, selling off a long-term asset, to get enough money to make this month's or this year's budget work, and then having an ongoing obligation to a for-profit corporation whose CEOs take millions of dollars and whose stockholders are... Well, anyhow, we're going to get into that in the second hour. And the third hour of our program, Wayne Jett is going to be here, a classical economist, lawyer, managing principal at Classical Capital, LLC, and the author of the book, The Fruits of Graft, Great Depressions Then and Now. And he makes a really startling assertion. He said, Great Depressions are man-made. They're intentional. 33, 2008... No accident. Say what? But what's going on in Wall Street right now, and what may or may not be spreading around the country, we'll see. But God bless these kids in Wall Street. And I say these kids, I know that there's some people there who are older than me, than I am, but by and large, this is a movement being driven by teenagers and people in their 20s who are looking at a world that 30 years of Reaganomics has handed them, or a country anyway, that's a disaster. Explicitly because of crony capitalism, bought off politicians, and supply-side economics. So Anonymous released a video on the web encouraging them. It's brilliant. Here's a piece of it.
Greetings, people of the world. We are Anonymous. As many of you are aware, over the past several days, significant demonstrations have been held in protest of the corrupt financial system that favors the richest 1% of our nation, while the remaining 99% have to deal with things such as abuse of our civil rights, overseas outsourcing of our jobs, and living off minimum wage while gas hovers around $3.50 a gallon. We would like to thank those in our national media that chose to cover the truth about the events of the Wall Street occupation. We must take to the streets and speak of the truth in our coffee shops and mall outlets. Our voices will be heard. Bloggers, dedicate your blogs to Occupy Wall Street. Website owners, write an article about Occupy Wall Street. People in urban areas, pass out and post up flyers about Occupy Wall Street. Social network users, flood your Twitter accounts with Occupy Wall Street hashtags. Post videos, articles, and any news about Occupy Wall Street. Share this call to action and encourage others to do the same.
Now, if that isn't a tag, you're it. I've never heard one. I mean, that was you know, okay, tag, you're it. Occupy Wall Street. Time to get out there. Time to show up. Time to participate. The revolutionary moment, or the evolutionary moment, is here. Americans are standing up, and young Americans in particular are standing up. And you know, what's fascinating is that, you know, back in the 60s, young Americans stood up because the government was trying to kill them. It was conscripting them and sending them off to Vietnam for no damn good reason. In fact, for some very bad reasons. And they knew it. And now young people are getting out of high school and out of college with no job prospects in a sinking economy. And if they do get a job, it pays less than what their parents' jobs did when their parents were their age in inflation-adjusted dollars. And they figured this out. This game has been scammed. Corporate profits last year were higher than ever in the history of America. Corporate profits were higher. So the people who make their money off corporate profits, the CEOs, the senior executives who are compensated with stock options, the Paris Hiltons of the world and the Warren Buffetts who make their living sitting around their butt waiting for the pool, sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to come in. Warren Buffett's a little more active than that, but the Paris Hiltons of the world, the Bush family heirs, the Helmsley family heirs, the heirs of multi-generational wealth, the Walton family heirs. They're doing very well, thank you. I mean, very well. And yet the average working person has seen their wages decline. Working opportunity. And this isn't because the workers are not available to work or they can't work hard. It's because a conscious decision was made with the introduction of Reaganomics and trickle-down economics to create an economic system where the gains of the system, instead of going to the workers in the middle class, as they had from the 30s until the 80s, where worker productivity and worker wages tracked each other, all those gains would instead go to the rich.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Coming up next, an Occupy Wall Street witness. This should be interesting. Broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as TV on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide. More people watching or listening to the Tom Hartman program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. Welcome back. J.A. Meyerson is on the line with us. J.A. is part of Occupy Wall Street, or the movement to Occupy Wall Street. J.A., hey, wait, and a contributor to Alternet as well. Hey, J.A., how you doing?
I'm very well. How are you, Tom?
Fine, fine. It seems to me that one of the most important dimensions of what's going on with Occupy Wall Street is a revisitation of something that you're too young to remember, I'm not, that during the Vietnam era, there was incredible community around people who were trying to resist the war, whether it was avoid the draft or whether it was being out in the streets and demonstrating or whether it was, SDS. Community formed. It was extraordinary. And it seems to me from, sitting here, I don't know how many miles away I am in D.C. from New York, but it seems like the same thing is going on there in New York from what I'm reading of your reporting.
Yeah, it sure is. And I'd point out that a lot of the genesis of that sort of communal feeling that goes on at Wall Street is rooted in another thing that happened a lot in the late 60s with groups that worked with SDS, including the Black Panthers, which is liberating space from imperial control, just claiming it as people space in the belly of the beast. And the Panthers did that, and it gives a group the impetus to social solidarity and to camaraderie when it cares for a space together, and that's another thing. That's a thing that we're taking from the 60s that's sort of generating what you're talking about.
Yeah, I remember a long occupation of one of the commons areas at MSU in 68, a very, very similar thing. How does that, for people who are watching or listening and don't really know what we're talking about, how does that play out? Tell a story. Give me an example.
Well, it's sort of a strange two-headed monster, the occupation of Wall Street, because on the one hand, it's a political statement, right, and a protest. And on the other hand, it's a community unto itself. So every day at 2 and 7, there's a general assembly, and a person, so the NYPD prohibits us from using electronic forms of amplification. So there's a thing called the people's mic. And what folks will do at the General Assembly, somebody will stand up speaking, and they'll speak in a short phrase, like brothers and sisters, and then everyone within earshot repeats it. And so in that way, the group amplifies the speaker. And people will meet and deliberate for hours and hours over anything. Any expenditure over $100 has to be run by the General Assembly, and everything has to happen by consensus. So last night at the 7 p.m. General Assembly, I estimate that there were 500 people there who sat there for 2.5 hours of small democratic minutiae working out issues, and it's the most exhilarating feeling you can't imagine. It was over at 9:30, and then people headed over to a talent show to spend the next hour and a half until self-imposed quiet hours began at 11 that the General Assembly also decided on by consensus. So this is the kind of thing that happens with a group of several hundred people every day.
Wow. Where did the phrase General Assembly come from?
I'm not sure. The General Assembly, the NYCGA, is a group that's been meeting and is sort of a group that helped plan this thing. But I know that in May of 68...
You said of the NYPGA? What's that?
CGA, the New York City General Assembly. The website is nycga.net. They have a lot of stuff about Occupy Wall Street if you want to visit there.
I know that... Who are they? What are they? Where did they come from?
It's just it's not an organization. It's just the group of activists in New York that sort of sparked the idea for this this Wall Street protest.
Interesting. Okay.
But General Assembly is the name that in French that the Parisian students used in May of 68 when they took over Paris.
Right.
They had General Assemblies in the Sorbonne that they were occupying and renaming parts of the city. They renamed the Latin Quarter the Heroic Vietnam Quarter until De Gaulle's tanks came in and busted the thing up. But what that was called there was the General Assemblies.
Right.
So it's obviously a phrase that's been around in liberation politics for a good long time.
Sure. Are you familiar with the history of the French Revolution?
To an extent, I guess.
Yeah. there be some dangers there. It's an interesting. That's very interesting. So that's how this community is coming about, and I'm assuming, you know, up till this point there have been no demands other than we are here. Does that stand?
In a sense, I mean, it's clear that what connects this group is an objection to the extent to which enormous wealth has an influence over American democratic politics. But it hasn't got a manifesto. It hasn't got a 5-point bullet point, you know, document to present. And I would point out, neither did the May 68 kids in France. And a 5-point bullet point document wouldn't have stopped the Gulf tanks. So it hasn't got demands, but it's clear that there are some unifying forces. And it's also worth noting that this being a direct democracy, where there are labor outreach committees and arts and culture committees and free food for everyone, free childcare. I saw a woman set up a free manicure place. There's a free library, free medical assistance, free legal assistance. It's all there and it's all for free. And anyone who can't look at that and deduce a demand on society and on other people to organize similar groups is missing the point entirely.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like this. I wonder what parallels there might be between this and the early American Revolution. That's remarkable. Jay, thanks for coming on and sharing with it. And the groups, very quickly, growing, static?
Oh, growing considerably.
Great.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Finish your sentence real quick.
It was the biggest we've seen last night.
That's great. That's great. J.A. Meyerson. JAMeyerson.com, the website. We'll be back.
It's where I learned about living. It's where I learned about love. It's where I learned about working hard and having a little with just enough. It's where I learned about Jesus and knowing where I stand. You can't take it or leave it. This is me. This is who I am.
Oh, remember that traitor who said that he was going to bed every night dreaming of the next Great Depression or recession because he could make so much money and Goldman Sachs rules the world? Isn't that cool? Of course, the right-wing media and the mainstream media, rather than focusing on the fact that that's actually how probably most traders think, that there have been articles recently both in psychology publications and in the Financial Times about how Wall Street traders score higher on sociopathy tests, on evaluations of whether or not they're sociopaths, than do sociopaths in prison. Because they are what's called high-functioning sociopaths. In other words, they're high-IQ sociopaths. They figured out how to make it, how to get around in society and have people not realize that they're sociopaths, but they still are. Whereas the guys who end up in prison aren't just, you know, they're not bright enough to conceal it. They just act on it. Or they didn't have the education. They weren't burning the family into a family that was able to get them into a college where they could get a master's degree in business or finance that would end them up with a job on Wall Street. But they're sociopaths nonetheless. So anyhow, this guy. So Sean, our producer, I mean, we've had the S-Men on the show before. She contacted them and said, was this one of your guys? And I have the email right here in front of me. No, it was not. In fact, their response was, ha! Along with a link to an interview with them pointing out that, no, this guy was not them. I find that very interesting, unless I'm being double-punked. But even if, the point is that this guy was reflecting how most people think. Okay, a lot in the news here. I want to get through some of these things and share with you what you need to know this and know why. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals a few months ago, or maybe it was a few weeks ago, said that Obamacare in its entirety had to be thrown out. Now, that would mean that a million young people under 26 right now, who have been put on their parents' policies in the last year, because over the last year, it's been almost a year now, Obamacare has, or the Affordable Care Act, if you want to be politically correct. I rather like Obamacare because I think he should get credit for doing something good. And, you know, I realize people say, oh, that's what Republicans call it derisively. Well, let's take these words back. You know, they call us liberals derisively. I'm proud to be a liberal, as Jack Kennedy said. But in any case, the 11th Circuit Court struck the whole thing down. One of the other circuit courts or appeals courts had struck down the mandate part of it. And another court and several other courts had said, no, it's just fine. So it's up in the air. Obviously, it has to go to the final court of appeals, as the Constitution defines the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court is going to decide at the time and place of their choosing whether Obamacare is constitutional. And the Department of Justice has said, please decide soon. And soon would mean in next spring, summer session. Presumably they'd hear the case in the spring, issue a decision in the summer, right in the middle of a political campaign. Now, this is a high wire bet by the Obama administration. And they're making this bet because the Supreme Court has been confronted with these kind of questions before. They were confronted with the question of whether Social Security was constitutional. That went before the Supreme Court back in 1937. And the Supreme Court said, yes, it is. And, you know, this ain't that different in some regards. They were asked if the Voting Rights Act was constitutional. And they said, yes, it is. They were asked if the Civil Rights Act was constitutional. They said, yes, it is. So if the Supreme Court acts rationally, and Think Progress laid this out, 7 of the 9 justices at various times have voted in ways that would support the individual mandate, which is the piece of Obamacare that is being most objected to. 7 of the 9 have voted in various times in various ways and ways that would indicate that they would be supportive of that. This was an idea, by the way, that came out of the Heritage Foundation and was first put forward as Mitt Romney pointed out last night on Fox News, was first put forward by Newt Gingrich, of all people. And it may well be that the Supreme Court will even say, you know, it's not really a mandate. Because there's no teeth to it. If you don't buy the insurance, you know, they're not going to come and take your house. They're not even going to force you to pay anything. There's an obligation to pay for the insurance that you're going to get, but you don't have to. There's no teeth in the law. There's no enforcement provision. Now, you can argue that there should be. I think there should be, but there isn't. So how can you have a mandate if there's a mandate in words only? So anyway, we'll see. The Obama administration is betting the Supreme Court is going to vote on their side. If they lose that bet, it's really going to hurt Obama going into the 2012 election. If he wins that bet, it's going to put a lot of wind behind his back. Or it may energize the right. I mean, Roe v. Wade was the Supreme Court affirming a woman's right to choose to have an abortion. And what did that do? That created a movement on the right. And maybe even on the right is the wrong way to say it, because a lot of it came, a lot of it came out of the Catholic Church, or the religious groups and fundamentalist Protestants who in many ways are on the left. They're opposed to the death penalty. They're opposed to wars. These things, many of these things completely transcend these old labels. I find it fascinating. New report from the Census Bureau. Racial inequality in our nation is getting worse. Not only that, for the first time in the history of our country, a minority group is now has the largest number of poor children, Hispanics. It used to be whites. And the reason was pretty simple. Whites were, substantial majority of Americans. Back, 50, 60, 80 years ago, they were 70-80% of the majority of the United States. Now it's about 3%, 54%, something like that. The fastest growing minority group has been Hispanics. They have outnumbered as a group African Americans, and their children living in poverty have outnumbered both African Americans and whites. We have 5 million poor white children in the United States, 6.1 million poor Hispanic children, and 4.4 million African American children. Fascinating. I mentioned Governor Brian Schweitzer First it was Vermont, now it's Montana. He wants to do single-payer health care. I think this is absolutely great. Retired Justice John Paul Stevens has come out and said he regrets, in 1976 when he was on the Supreme Court, he regrets his vote to reinstate the death penalty. And it was the Troy Davis case that made him do it, that made him feel that way. Lewis Powell, by the way, also voted to maintain the death penalty in the United States. It was in the 80s. It was in a case out of Georgia again. And he was the swing vote. Lewis Powell is now dead, but he gave some very interesting interviews after his retirement with the BBC. They did this long interview with him. And he said he regretted that too. So some of the stuff going on right now, Chris Christie, I don't know. I'm not even sure I want to go there. Mitt Romney's response to being challenged on flip-flopping, here's what Mitt Romney had to say. Clip one, Jacob.
In the private sector, if you don't change your view when the facts change, well, you'll get fired for being stubborn and stupid. All right? And so it was Winston Churchill said, when the facts change, I change too, madam. What do?
Yeah. So, but be careful of any Winston Churchill quote that has the word madam in it. Oh, my. You can Google that one. Lou in Everett, Washington. Hey, Lou, what's up?
Well, I have a question.
Yeah.
What is the function of Wall Street?
The function of Wall Street is to allow, and it used, by the way, it used to be completely separated from the function of the Chicago Board of Trade, which was where commodities were traded, which is a whole different thing. The function of Wall Street historically was to be a place where companies could go to raise money to grow their business. And where
right,
if
that
people
hasn't been true since George Romney screwed up his new stock release when he was trying to salvage Rambler.
Well, companies are still going public, and
right,
and,
they
and then
public, but they have to already exist. You can't create a company.
Right, but no, you can't, and you couldn't create. I, to the best of my knowledge, you could never create a company on Wall Street. You had to already exist. You have to meet certain minimum thresholds to be accepted by Wall Street in terms of net value, capitalization, all those kind of things. But the other reason for Wall Street was so that people could invest their money over the long term, and if they wanted to buy a piece of a company, they could conveniently do it through Wall Street. Where Wall Street has gone wrong, in my opinion, is high-frequency trading. And this is what Europe is taking out. Europe now is on the verge of passing a STET tax, a security transaction exchange tax, or excise tax, like we had here in the United States from World War I until the mid-1960s, 64, I think it was. A very small tax on every trade. Right now, you've got big companies like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan who have machines, computers, that are trading literally 100,000 or a million times a second stock trades. It makes up as much as 70% of the total volume of the New York Stock Exchange. And they're making a hundredth of a penny for a second and a half. And when you add all that up, they're making millions of dollars a day. And basically what they're doing is just skimming money out of the system. That is not why Wall Street exists. And a STET tax will bring that to a grinding halt. And I find it odd that Tim Geithner is telling the Europeans, you shouldn't do that STET tax, not a good idea.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Meanwhile, here in the United States, not only have we learned that Tim Geithner basically hurt Obama, shall we say, but also the national nurses are pushing for a STET tax. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And the answer is clearly no. And by the way, be sure to contact your member of Congress. They still need a couple more sponsors for H.R. 1351 to restore the post office to functionality, basically to take out this awful poison pill that the Republicans put in 2006, the Postal Reform Act or whatever it was called at the time. And H.R. 1351, let them know that you support the post office. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, Jim in Jamestown, North Carolina. Hey, Jim, what's up? Jim?
For years. Yes.
Yeah. Sorry.
I'm here.
Okay, what's up?
Okay, so I'm a love your show, fan for years. I have a question as you're talking about Obamacare, being brought up before the Supreme Court and testing its constitutionality. it seems that all the objections from the right are that it's unconstitutional to mandate people to buy something from a private company. But why aren't – I don't hear more people replying about – or citing the Militia Acts of 1792, where the citizens were required – all able-bodied male citizens were required to buy muskets. So what you would get from a private company.
Well, that's very interesting. I didn't even know about the Militia Acts of 1792 that required people to buy muskets.
Right.
I would have to think these were state laws, not federal laws.
No, it was passed by Washington.
By George
Washington? They were George Washington.
Okay, I will Google that during the top of the hour. Thank you for that.
Okay.
The Militia Act.
Right. There's two Militia Acts. They were both in 1792.
Okay.
Also, then the Congress set up a health care system for sailors not soon after that. I think it was during the presidency of John Adams, and
yes.
You can also Google that.
Yeah, we've talked about that one on the air, and
right.
Yeah, and that one had basically a mandate in it that you had to buy into, and
right.
That all the sailors had to buy into, whether they wanted to or not. Although you know you could argue times are different, but excellent point. Thank you. And also, you know, when this thing was put together, it was put together basically as a tax, not a mandate. That is to say, everybody pays a $700 tax. To give health insurance to everybody. And the way you can avoid paying the tax is by buying a health insurance policy. Then you get a tax break. And, you know, it's sort of like saying everybody pays income taxes, but the way you can avoid paying some of your income taxes is to have a mortgage. You can deduct it from your mortgage. And I suspect that that will be one of the bases for their, for their argument on this. Armin in Braden in Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Well, that's your opinion, but Obama's still making our overly expensive, as far as global competition goes, healthcare system cost another $1 trillion more.
Yeah, the fact that there's no public option and there's no ability to buy into Medicare.
We're digging the ditch, Tom. Tom, we're digging the ditch so damn deep, and you know it as you sit there on the radio. The only way we're going to get out of this is to change the trajectory of progressively consuming more than we're producing. And we're going the wrong way, man. Our money's going to extinction. And they know it. The globalists, the Goldman Sachs, they don't care. Because they're skimming it all off the top by inflating and deflating. And the only way we can get out of this, we're going to have to remain America, sovereign, independent, and somewhat free. We're going to have to go back to making the things we consume.
Yep.
And look how well it worked for China. And we're going to have to do it with money that's sovereign currency, that's not by some crime syndicate banking international global syndicate like we have now. It's got to be our own money, debt-free, created out of thin air just the way they do it. And it has to go out, and it has to add value, multiplier. And the only way you get that is from making things, taking 10 cents worth of dirt, earth, and making something worse, $3, like a semiconductor.
Yep.
Or cars, or clothes.
Armin, you're singing my song. I've written two books on this.
Well,
as you know.
We have to do this, Tom.
Yeah.
We're just sitting here. You can put everybody in school tomorrow and make them physicians and attorneys. It's only going to aggravate the situation because they'll have more money to consume things we don't make.
Well,
and China's just sitting back laughing their ass off at
America. And this was the point that I made. Thank you, Armin. Well said. This was the point that I made in the White House, talking to some of the White House economic advisors about 2 years ago. In which I said, you know, okay, you're going to do this stimulus, or you're doing this stimulus, aren't you stimulating China and other countries around the world? Because yes, you're putting money into people's pockets, and they take that money down to Walmart and they buy something. And where does that money end up? We need to change our trade policies. June in Grand Rapids. Hey, June, what's up?
I was wondering, with Obamacare, has anyone broken down the cost for individuals to have that versus the outrageous prices they have to pay through the insurance companies?
Well, what we know is that at the beginning of this year, at the beginning of 2011 or 2012, at the beginning of the next year, the requirement kicks in. And this is one of the things that's really got a lot of people in the insurance industry freaked out, that they can no longer spend one penny more than 20% of all the money they take in for their bonuses, their raises, their corporate jets, gold-plated faucets, birthday parties with giant cakes and hookers, all that kind of stuff. They can no longer do that, or they can't do that if they wanted to. They can't do that anymore with anything more than 20% of the money that they get. Right now they're using 30%, 35%, 40%, whatever of the, you know, of the money. And one of the provisions of Obamacare that kicks in at the end of the year is that the health insurance companies must spend 80 cents on every dollar on actually caring for people. Now, that's something that, you know, is easily doable. Switzerland is the only other country that doesn't have a national health care system like us. But what they have is a mandate that everybody buy insurance, and they forbid any health insurance company from operating on a for-profit basis. So all of their insurance companies spend $95, $96, $97 out of every $100 on care. Obama's care is requiring 80%, so $80 out of 100. So that, at the very least, will in all probability reduce health care costs. June, but beyond that, I don't know of any specific breakout. Thank you very much. Up next, a rumble on private prisons. Is prison part of the commons or not?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Len Gilroy is on the line with us with the Reason Foundation. Reason.com is their website. After John Kasich won the Ohio gubernatorial election last fall, one of his first appointees was a guy by the name of Gary Moore to be the state director of rehabilitations and corrections. Turns out that what Moore used to do was be the managing director of the CCA, Correction Corporation of America, a company that not only pushes to build more private prisons, but also lobbies lawmakers. I'm quoting from an article by Scott Keyes, lobbies the lawmakers to put more people in jail. And Ohio this month becomes the first state prison, the state in the nation to privatize a prison, to sell a prison paid for with taxpayers' dollars, land taken by eminent domain, and sell it to a for-profit prison company, CCA. So, Len, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me today.
I don't understand why it is a good thing for us to be privatizing our commons.
Well, thanks, Tom, for the question. The reason that you're seeing a lot of interest today in not only corrections in terms of privatization, but really in a lot of different facets of public service, is the simple fact that states, local governments, and federal government, they're out of money. They're looking to partner with the private sector to deliver cost savings, to get higher performance through contracting than they might get in the public sector today. And, you know, policymakers are basically looking to solve these crises in part, and not in total, but in part, through, you know, creative partnerships with the private sector to save money.
But that seems like nonsense. For example, in Ohio, the money that they're going to get from selling this entire prison is going to close 1 year's worth of budget deficit. This is the same thing that happened when Mayor Daley privatized the parking meters in Chicago to get a whole bunch of cash over a short term and then give away this stuff for years and years. It was the same thing with the Chicago Skyway. It's the same thing with – there have been a number of privatizations around the country where governments are in trouble. You're right. We have this crisis that 30 years of insane economic policies called Reaganomics and trickle-down economics has produced. We've got a Great Depression brought about by Phil Gramm pushing, you know, repealing Gramm-Leach-Bliley, repealing the Glass-Steagall Act, and with the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, making it possible for Enron, which his wife was on the board of, and others to make billions at the cost of wiping out the entire economy of the United States. I got that. And states are desperate for funds. And you've got a bunch of right-wing cranks funded by the Koch brothers through ALEC that have done things like in the state of Oregon said you have to have a two-thirds majority to raise taxes on anybody for anything, and so the state is like stuck. You know, I get that, you know, the conservatives have created a disaster and put a lot of states in a box. What I don't get is why they would be so desperate as to sell off the commons. I mean, the whole point of we the people, the reason the founders created this country was to provide for the commons. And our prisons, if nothing else, our police, our firefighters, our courts, and our prisons are part of the commons.
Well, Tom, you have a lot of issues there packed within that statement. So let me kind of go back to your a couple of the major themes. First, I mean, you mentioned divesting a public asset and then spending the proceeds. And, I think that you'd see a lot of fiscal conservatives that would agree with you that...
Well, give me one example where that hasn't happened.
Okay, well, the Indiana Toll Road. When Governor Daniels leased in the state of Indiana, leased the Indiana Toll Road to private investors, concessionaires to operate, they invested the proceeds of that, which were, about $3 billion or so, into an interest-bearing account that was dedicated to transportation assets over a long term, delivering new transportation that the state did not have funding for.
Okay, so here's a really simple question then. Why would any company buy or lease, take the lease on, the Indiana Toll Road if they didn't think they could make money on it? And if they can make money on it, why shouldn't we, the people, be making money on it?
Well, because actually what you find in the public sector is that in those situations in which governments are running enterprises, and whether you want to look at, the post office or a turnpike system, a toll road system, or a state-run liquor store operation, what you tend to find is that, take aside the ideological question of should the state be in that business in the first place, and we might disagree on that. I would say no, government shouldn't be in the business of business. But, let's take that aside. What you find is that government, under political pressure to do things like keep rates low, to keep prices from resembling what a market price would look like, what you find is that they will keep prices low and then underinvest in the asset to the point where you have water systems, toll road systems, et cetera, that literally start to crumble under the public sector. I call it the, sort of the public sector infrastructure death spot.
What you're describing is Reaganomics. I mean, this is the, what politicians, first of all, that you mentioned the post office. Had there not been poison pill legislation in 2006 passed by Republican Congress and George W. Bush that forced the post office to, over a 10-year period, fully fund health retirement benefits for people 75 years from now, people who have not even been born, the post office would be showing a $1.2 billion a year surplus right now. That was a crisis that was manufactured by government. Just like Medicare. Had the Republicans not pushed through Medicare Part D, the drug program, and then said, and we're not going to fund it, and you can't negotiate prices with pharmaceutical companies to buy it wholesale, you have to buy full retail. Another poison pill. So, I'll give you that conservatives have over and over and over again, instead of having an honest discussion about programs they don't like, they've sabotaged them. Bush didn't like FEMA, so instead he fired the guy that was running FEMA under Clinton and doing a brilliant job, and replaced him with a guy who was the lawyer for a horse show judging company. I mean, but that does not justify selling off our commons, and it doesn't establish any kind of a precedent. I mean, the post office has been doing just fine since the formation of this country, thank you very much. The military functions just fine. You can argue that it's being used in inappropriate ways, but that's by civilian control. You've got the IRS operates just fine. The Social Security Administration has never missed a check, and it's going to be solvent for the next 24 years, a small tweak, and it's solvent forever. You've got all these government programs that actually work better than the private sector. And the proof of that is look at the health care in any country, in any developed country in the world, even some of the undeveloped. Look at Costa Rica. Look at the health care around the world where the profit motive has been taken out. Switzerland, for example, doesn't have a national healthcare system. It's all companies, but if you try to start a for-profit company to offer primary healthcare in Switzerland, they'll throw your ass in jail. And as a consequence of that, their healthcare costs are half of what ours are. Whereas we've got people like, Bill McGuire making $1.5 billion off United Healthcare. I mean, that should be our commons too, healthcare.
Well, Tom, you've got a lot of issues there, I think, but basically where we may disagree.
No, I don't. It's one essential thing.
Well, on the one, I think that we might have different frameworks here that are different lenses to which to view what the term the commons means. To me, for instance, I'll give you two examples. Would you consider New York City Central Park to be
you know, some privatized operation that is off limits to the common.
Well, what we're talking about are prisoners.
Could I finish?
And prisoners are human beings. They're members of our society. They're citizens of our country, and they are, and they should be, and the facilities in which they are held should be considered part of the commons.
They will still be held in those facilities in Ohio. They will still be held in those same facilities. It's just a question of who owns the actual brick and mortar of the building.
No, it's a question of who profits over them. A for-profit company has one goal, and you have to acknowledge this, Len.
If that for-profit company doesn't deliver on cost savings, if they don't deliver what they promise, I guarantee you they are not going to make a profit. So you're offloading risk as well in these sorts of situations that the public sector and taxpayers, us, would normally bear. And, you know,
I just think the idea of making money off prisoners is reprehensible. Prisoners should be rehabilitated or they're going to cost society. They shouldn't be an opportunity to make money.
Well, Tom, I agree with you fully on your last point, which is that prisoners should be rehabilitated and we should be spending less and putting fewer
people. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Len Gilroy, Reason.com. You can read all about it. Len, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Appreciate it.
15 minutes past the hour.
I get locked up, they won't let me out. They won't let me out. Locked up, they won't let me out. No.
20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And John Collins, a reporter with the Minnesota Independent, is on the line. He's been on this beat of the privatization of prisons and doing a brilliant job of it. John, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us about CCA, Correction Corporations of America, and how they're getting these contracts in these various states to privatize prisons, like most famously in Ohio, because they actually bought a public prison, but in other states they're building them from scratch. What's the deal?
Well, CCA is just one of a handful of these private prison companies that proliferate around the United States and around the world since the 80s. And essentially, their tactic that has allowed them to expand into this area where we typically think that the public will take care of it, public infrastructure, is through a kind of two-pronged approach of political influence and, you know, campaign donations. So at the same time as they're able to elect the folks that they want to elect through, you know, expanded campaign donations, they're also able to change some of the laws through organizations like ALEC, which they were a part of for a number of decades, although they say that they're not now, in order to actually make people's prison sentences longer or more harsh.
Let me explain what ALEC is real quickly for our listeners and viewers.
Sure, American Legislative Exchange Council. And essentially what it is a group of corporations and state legislators that essentially writes legislation. Like, for instance, SB 1070, you know, that came out of ALEC. Three strikes, you're out. That came out of ALEC. And these are ones which CCA and other prison corporations like GEO were involved in, at least in the drafting portion of it.
So it sounds like what you're saying, just to reduce it to its most fundamental, is that these for-profit corporations lobby for laws that would increase the number of people in prison, and then they go to the states and say, oh, you've got more prisoners, we'll build prisons for you, and we will house them at a cost lower than what it costs you to do it, because we've figured out ways to cut corners, or we're more efficient, or we'd like to do it on a cost-plus basis, so we'll bid on a low price, and you're going to end up paying a high price.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
That's astounding. And examples of how that's happening.
You know, for instance, in Florida, for instance, CCA put, you know, tons of money into both electing officials who were sympathetic to them and then into lobbying the state legislature. You know, Florida is one of the states that...
Now, tons of money. This was $438,494, right, from 2003 to 2011.
Right.
And then a GEO Group subsidiary donated $822,000 in just the 2010 election cycle. Mostly to Republican, whole chunks of cash going to the Republican Party of Florida.
Yeah, and essentially what will happen is there's legislation there that is kind of like the Arizona legislation that
will result in more prisoners, essentially. And you know, they have said in some of their, their quarterly reports that immigration detention is a growth industry, you know, that that's an area where they can see some, CCA at least, sees growth possible.
When I flew out of Reagan Airport a couple of weeks ago, and you come down, if you take the metro there, you come down the long escalator into the airport, and there was this giant sign hanging there, about 6 feet wide, 20 feet tall, of picture of the Statue of Liberty. And the text said, "Welcome to the United States of America, home of 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners." Obviously, CCA and these other private prison companies want to increase that percentage. What's being done to reduce it? That seems shameful.
To reduce the amount of people in prison?
Yeah.
That I'm not sure of.
I mean, this was an NAACP poster. Obviously, they're speaking out against this situation. But it seems like some of these ALEC laws, like the three strikes law in California, we had a guy call who said his brother got sent to prison for life because he stole two candy bars. It was his third strike. And it's like these laws are irrational, these minimum mandatory sentencing, these drug laws, all the stuff that ALEC has been pushing for to create more prisoners. And in many states, that means more people who can't vote, by the way, which is another big thing that ALEC is all in favor of. ALEC, heavily funded by the Koch brothers. What can we do to stop this?
You know, there's organizations like the Justice Policy Institute that, you know, they put out an amazing report, just about the growth of private prison industry. So I think that awareness is probably, the area.
Shouldn't there be an effort to make it illegal to privatize the commons? And I would extend that from privatizing our prisons to privatizing our vote. The commons is what our country was created for.
You know, I think there are organizations moving towards things like that. In Minnesota, for instance, we have a legislator that tried to pass a legislation asking that Minnesota itself not use private prisons for any of our prisoners.
Right.
I think there was a lot of reasons rather than, humanitarian reasons that
right.
she did that. But that's a step in the direction you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, and economic reasons as well. You know, they always say, well, for-profit companies can do it more efficiently. But, very often for-profit companies end up doing it far less efficiently. And our healthcare system in the United States, I think, is the best example of that. And,
and prisons are a great example of that, too. For instance, the Arizona Department of Corrections did a study, which came out, I think, a month or two ago, about how much it actually costs to house people privately versus publicly. And the private prisons cost about $1,600 more per prisoner. And when you factor in that we got 130,000 people in private prisons in the United States, that's a pretty big sum.
That's millions. And that's millions that ends up in the pockets of CEOs and stockholders. And what the hell are they doing making money off prisoners? It blows my mind. John Collins with the Minnesota Independent, he wrote a great piece. The title is Private Prison Companies' Growth Went Hand-in-Hand with Political Influence. You can read it over at the website, minnesotaindependent.com. John, thanks for the great work you're doing, and thanks for coming on the program.
Yeah, thank you very much, Tom.
Good talking with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Oh, Rick Perry's wife has come out and stepped in it. I'll tell you about that after this, and we'll pick up your calls.
And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on.
Yeah, it'll drag on a hell of a lot longer if it's a private prison corporation. I'll make sure that happens.
Meow, meow, meow.
Oh, it's a Higgins alert. My crazy cat who likes to attack people. He's mellowing a bit. He's getting a little older. But there are still certain people. And there's a couple people he likes now, but there's still a lot of people he likes to attack. Anyhow, it's the rise of the cyborg rats. It appears the advantage in the eternal struggle between cat and mouse has now shifted. A team of researchers at the University of Tel Aviv have created what they're calling a digital cerebellum that can be implanted into the brain of rats to mimic brain functions that were previously lost. So far, the robotic brain has only been used for simple processes, such as causing a rat to blink in response to certain stimulus. But researchers are still calling the event a remarkable leap forward in technology, and its uses will soon be limitless. So it could be just a matter of time before the same cyborg brain technology is used on humans to replenish or even control our brain's activities. In fact, I think it's already happening. You can watch the clinical trials every week during the Republican debates. Yeah. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, Francis in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Francis, what's up?
Hi, Tom. This is Fran. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. You're welcome. What's up, Fran?
I was at the postal rally the other day.
Good on you.
Or at Sarbanes, John Sarbanes' office.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a wonderful time. I mean, because there's about 30 of us. But over the whole country, something like 50,000 people was at the combined offices.
Yes, on Tuesday there was on Monday we had one of the senior officers of the Postal Workers Union on the program talking about how they were going to be doing that on Tuesday. And this is all about House Resolution 1351, getting this thing passed.
Right.
1351, H.R. 1351. If they can, they're stuck right now because they need a couple more Republicans to sign on to it. So if you're in a district represented by a Republican,
I got a Democrat.
Yeah, well, I believe all the Democrats have signed on to this thing. But
well,
call them anyway, no matter where you live.
The tension in the post office is so bad, it's pathetic.
Yeah.
And since Reagan took over. Hello, Tom.
Yeah,
are you there?
I'm listening.
When Reagan took over, the tension in the post office went up, and you start having shootings. Where else have you had over 100 and some people killed and 600 and some people wounded?
Well, I think
they can't figure out what the problem is.
Yeah.
Because of the draconian rules that they put these people under and the stress.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. And Reagan began the war on workers. But let's also keep in mind, and thanks for the call, Fran, let's also keep in mind that this is the reason why, or the reason why, the Republicans put this poison pill legislation in 2006 that required the Postal Service to fully fund the retirement health benefits of retirees 75 years from now, people who have not yet even been born, over a 10-year period. They put it in there to cripple the Postal Service. Now, why would they do that? Because the largest employer in America is Walmart. The second largest employer in America is the U.S. Postal Service. And it is unionized. And Republicans hate unions, and they get a lot of money from private companies like FedEx and UPS and whatnot who want to compete with the post office. So they're out, of course they're going to poison pill the post office. And if they can, and Darrell Issa is leading the charge, and you might want to call his office and let him know what you think about that, the congressman from California. Darrell Issa is leading the charge to dismantle the post office. And it's wrong. And it's basic union busting. That's really what's going on here. It's just absolutely wrong. Paul in Lucerne. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Let me talk about private prisons. Do you know the first private jail in the country just recently had the county had to take it over, and it cost the county something like $1.3 million?
Yeah, we did that story about 2 weeks ago when it came out in the news here on the show.
Oh, okay. Well, I've been missing your show sometimes. I've been really busy at work. So this whole privatizing thing, it's ridiculous. And this third strike thing, you don't have to be striked at the courthouse. Okay, you go to prison, and then you go through a review board, and then they decide whether you're going to be striked or not. They up your sentence. So that guy that stole the candy bars could have been got 2-3 years for petty theft, of multiple things like that.
Right.
Then when he got to prison, they take a look at his record and decide to strike him and convert it to a 25 to life.
Wow.
That happens a lot.
Wow.
Especially here in California.
I wonder when the day will come, or if it has already come in some states, where those people who are making those decisions are locally elected or appointed by corporations or with big corporate donors.
It's just the prison guards, Tom.
The prison guards?
It's prison guards that get to make the decision.
They themselves. So in a private prison, it would be the employees of a private corporation.
Well, right now it's just prison guards, and there's not too much private stuff going on here in California, but they're talking about it.
Oh yeah, you bet that they're talking about it.
But
Paul, thanks a lot.
We got a governor right now. It's not going to let that happen.
Okay, let's hope so. Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, you're fortunate to have Jerry Brown in there. John in San Angelo, Texas. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, hi Tom. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'm calling in regard to the privatization on prisons.
Mm-hmm.
One of my problems with that has always been, it's my understanding that these facilities that were built and paid for by taxpayer dollars, 100 cents on the dollar, are often sold to these private places for pennies on the dollar.
Sure.
Thereby ripping off taxpayers, et cetera. Is my feeling on that correct?
It has certainly been the case with a lot of other things, you know, from parking meters to highways and whatnot. Yeah, absolutely. Particularly when you consider the current value of land and what it would cost a private corporation to come in and do that. Yeah, absolutely.
So in my way of thinking, the politicians are actually robbing the taxpayers.
Yeah. I would not disagree with that. I think that when John Kasich is doing this kind of stuff, absolutely. And the taxpayers are getting screwed, and they're getting locked into these 75-year contracts, where over the first couple of years of it, the corporation might be losing money or just making a little bit of money, and they're handing off a fair amount of money to the state, so the state can close budget gaps and feel very proud of themselves, and the governor, who's only looking for one term because next time around he's going to run for president or something, gets to say, hey, I closed the budget in my state, but then the people of that state are stuck for the next 75 years. So 25, 30, 40, 50 years from now, nobody's even going to remember when it was privatized. They just know that they have to keep paying this private corporation who can charge whatever they damn well please.
Yeah, and one other parallel. Can we parallel this privatization with the Enron debacle back in, what was it, 2002?
Yeah.
Being that many of the power plants that were paid for by municipalities, et cetera, were scooped up by Enron and then run into the ground.
Oh, I lived through that in Portland, Oregon. It's also called PGE, but it's not PG&E like in California. The Portland Gas and Electric, I think it is. But it's PGE.
So is my belief correct?
And it was, this was part of Enron. Okay. And when Enron failed, this became its own private company, and the city tried to buy it. And the city actually tried to buy it for even more than they were asking for it. And they simply said, no, we're not going to sell it to a city. We're only going to sell it to another for-profit corporation. It's like a club. I remember having conversations with several city council members. This split the city council. They were one vote short. They needed the mayor to step up and break that vote. He was afraid to do it because he was afraid that they had so much money that their campaign contributions would destroy him in the next election, in my opinion. And, you know, it was a travesty. And so to this day, people in Portland, Oregon are having to buy their electricity from a private for-profit corporation, which is, you know, generally operating in the interest of its stockholders and its executives and not the best interests of the people. There's just no other way to describe that. And it's tragic. Kelly in Berkeley. Hey, Kelly, what's up?
Hi, I can't believe I got through. I'm a regular listener.
Well, thank you for
calling. I was listening yesterday and thinking about really the biggest threats to reelecting Obama and what's the biggest threats to our democracy. And I put down four, and I'd like you to either disagree or,
sure,
you know. Okay, so one is the voting machines, which can be hacked.
Yep, that's a problem.
In different uninformed and uneducated public.
That's probably even a bigger problem, yeah.
Media management that leaves vast groups in parts of the country that can't get a differing opinion.
Yeah, and this is the result of consolidation. This is the result of Reagan's stopping the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act in 82. So where you used to have, you know, four, five, six newspapers in a town and competing points of view you know, I remember when I was growing up, the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News, two statewide newspapers, one had a business section, one had a labor section. One was the Republican paper, one was the Democratic paper. Now it's all just one paper, and there's no more a labor section anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, last week was my forced listening, where I make myself listen to the right. And then disenfranchisement of the voters. The
yes.
28 states with the voter ID laws. And I've been looking for that list of the 28 states. Do you have it posted, or could you post it?
I can look around for it. And, in fact, I'm guessing the people in our chat room will get on that and find it. And so it'll probably be in our newsletter tonight. It shouldn't be too hard to track down. So
okay.
Go ahead real quickly.
And do you see other things? I mean, what would you list as the top four?
I would say number one, and everything else flows out of this, is the Supreme Court's repeated assertion that corporations are people and money is speech. All these other evils that you've described flow out of that, in my opinion. And that's the number one thing that we need to do, is we need to fix that. Thank you, Kelly. Kelly, thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your calls in the Talk Radio, and we'll check in with the Talk Radio News Service here in Washington, D.C. Find out what's the latest going on in the world.
Don't want to have to prove a point. Just want to know they're on my side. Just want to smile and inspire. Has anybody seen why?
Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you, and welcome back. Richard in Jefferson City, Missouri. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good.
Hey, I was calling about private prisons, and they did you hear about the Pennsylvania judges that had the juvenile prison?
Oh, yeah, yeah, where the judge himself ended up going to prison because he had been basically taking bribes from the private prison corporation to refer juveniles into his prison when they, you know, had committed crimes like jaywalking.
Yeah, $2.6 million in kickbacks is what it was, two judges.
Yeah.
And, one of the kids, one of the trumped up charges was, one of the kids got online and made fun of one of the administrators and got a 90-day sentence.
Right. Right. And this is the kind of thing that happens when you've got the profit motive driving something that should be part of the public good. You know, the commons is protecting the public good. It's not making money off the public good. And this, in my opinion, this whole thing and this whole, defense of it, by all these think tanks and front groups that are largely funded by the Koch brothers and the other right-wingers, is a direct assault on the democratic institutions, small-d democratic institutions of this country, and an assault that is not a good thing. Richard, thank you very much for the call. Janet in Catline, Georgia?
Kathleen,
Georgia.
Yes.
Okay.
Tom, I wanted to talk with you about how really there's nothing new under the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Profiting from the labor of prisoners is certainly not new. Here in Georgia and the other southern states, we had a system that started right after the Civil War called the convict lease system.
Yep.
And private individuals could lease prisoners from the state, and the prisoners, of course, were by and large African Americans, and the states used a loophole in the 13th Amendment, which does allow essentially slavery as punishment for a crime.
Right.
And this existed in the southern states until the late 1920s. Essentially, what got rid of it was the really horrific press that was out there, the notoriety that this received. The film, you know, I Was a Prisoner on a Georgia Chain Gang.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was the convict lease system. So, I'm wondering when these people who are allowing these, for-profit prisons into their states, when are they going to realize, haven't we heard this song before?
Well, and we're seeing this all over the country. There are even state-run prisons that are allowing private corporations to come into their prisons and set up assembly lines or manufacturing things so that they can use prison labor. And, you know, the argument is, we're teaching these people skills, we're giving them a job, but the fact of the matter is that they're also competing in the marketplace with companies that are having to hire people at the very least at minimum wage, and these people are making 10 cents an hour. And I lived in Georgia for 15 years and in suburban Atlanta, and I repeatedly heard the story, although I've never verified it, that the founding of the state of Georgia, or at least a good chunk of what is now the state of Georgia, was actually the pre-colonial founding, the original settling of it, was that it was being used after they stopped using Australia. England was using the area that is Georgia as a prison colony. Have you heard that also?
Yes, I have. And I don't know exactly how. I'm like you. I don't know how to verify it.
Yeah.
But I have often heard that.
I'll track it down. I understand that accounts for why there's so many Scotch-Irish in the mountains of Georgia that which was basically the same people who were sent off to Australia because they were causing problems for the United Kingdom. But anyhow, that's a little bit off topic. I just thought I'd ask since you're from Georgia. Janet, thanks a lot for the call.
Sure. Thank
great
you.
To, great Tom. To hear from you. Thank you very much. Linda in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hey. Hi, Tom. I just want to get back to something you were saying about Tim Geithner and the stet tax.
Yeah.
About a year or a year and a half ago, with a group of people, we went and met Heath Shuler, you know, our blue dog conservative, and he was buying Tim Geithner's line that a stet tax would make us uncompetitive, would make
right.
Wall Street uncompetitive.
Right. Now Europe
so
is doing it,
So if France
though.
And Germany are in the process of doing this tax by 2014, that, of course, undermines his whole rationale, which I'm assuming is why he's telling them not to do it.
Yes. Well, he's telling them not to do it because Tim Geithner is basically a creature of Wall Street and the banks, and the banks make money in the absence of a stet tax on things like high-frequency trading, which produces absolutely no social good. It just allows, you know, a small number of insiders, people who have bought or earned or whatever their seats on Wall Street, their ability to be traders, to skim hundreds of millions of billions of dollars off the top of the stock market. And
right.
And Europe is saying no. So the argument is that all that trading is going to come to the United States, and the Europeans are saying, fine, we don't care, let it go, because what's going to go with it is volatility and the risk of crashes.
Right. And the stet tax, you know, Peter DeFazio had that great bill, Let Wall Street Pay for Main Street, which
yep.
was, you know, like a trifecta. It raises money, created jobs, and held the people accountable who created this mess. And I think I was so disappointed that Obama decided to keep Geithner. I think he's the worst, one of the worst appointments that this president has that totally undermines his ability to restructure the economy to bring some sort of justice to it, which is what one of the reasons why I voted for Obama. So
yeah.
It's been a very big disappointment for me to have Geithner still there.
Well, yeah, and it has been for many of us, and, you know, you don't always get what you want, but sometimes you get a little bit of it.
All right,
you have to
take
paraphrase
care.
The
Thank
Rolling
you.
Stones. Thanks, Linda. We have to work to build grassroots movements in the United States from the bottom up to be the force that pushes and propels not just President Obama, but all of our politicians in the direction of a more just America, a more progressive America, a healthier America, a more prosperous America, an America that is here for Americans. And by that, I mean changing our international trade policies so we're not an America that is here for the transnational corporations. Up next, what happens when you rob the young people of America? Stay tuned. We'll be back. 57 minutes past the hour.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Ellen Ratner, by the way, is in South Sudan right now. Those of you wondering where did Ellen go today? Why didn't we do an interview with Talk Radio News? Ellen's out, and other folks are filling in, and sometimes they show up, and sometimes they don't, and whatever it may be. So, anyway, do we have or not? No, we don't. Okay. There's been a lot going on, and a lot that we've been talking about throughout the day, and one of the things I find most interesting is I teased this actually an hour and a half ago. This is clip number three, Jacob. This is Rick Perry's wife, Anita, bragging about the fact that 1,500 people a day are coming into Mexico. She doesn't add, by the way, that many of them are coming into Texas, that many of them are coming from Mexico. And this is why Rick Perry is a pariah in the Republican Party. Is that he has defended giving in-state tuition rates, $100,000 discount over the course of a four-year college education, in-state tuition rates to the children of illegal immigrants, which, frankly, I think is a fine thing to do. If kids came here with their parents and it wasn't their decision, they had no say in it, why should they be denied an education? They should be able to go to school wherever they happen to be living. And but you know, he said that in the Republican primary, and they're going after him. Now, here's his wife defending those immigrants and others coming into the state and being paid the minimum wage, because it's a wonderful thing. At least it's a job. Here she is.
We've got a great job market. He knows how to create jobs. We have 1,500 people moving to Texas every day to find a job. I'm not going to tell you they're all high-paying
jobs. They're not.
But they're a job, even if they're a minimum wage job.
Yeah, even slaves have jobs.
That's what people are hungry for.
Yeah, even slaves have jobs. I mean, you know, they got a job. Oh, man. So, anyway, let's just get back into, you know, some of the stuff that's been going on here. Ron in Portland. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I've been meaning to call you for a long time. Thanks for taking my call. I'm curious. I know that you have said that all of these problems with insurance started, I guess, health insurance started when we went from nonprofit health insurance and providers to for-profit. And I'm wondering, why wouldn't that be easier to go back to that, or more desirable to go back to that, rather than a single-payer system? Why do you prefer the single-payer system over a return to the old system, which seemed to work pretty well?
Right. That may actually work. What you're describing is how it works in Switzerland. Switzerland does not have a national single-payer system. It's one of the few European countries that doesn't. Instead, Switzerland requires all of their citizens to buy health insurance from a private health insurance company. And if the citizens make so little money that they can't afford to buy it, the state has a fund to pay for it. Now, the difference is that in Switzerland, health insurance companies are not allowed to operate on a for-profit basis. And there's a huge difference between a not-for-profit company and a for-profit company. A for-profit company has as its first mission in life to make money. And its second mission is to, you know, provide health care, or, you know, teach students, or, you know, whatever, fill in the blank. A not-for-profit company has as its first goal in life to do what it's commissioned to do. In other words, a not-for-profit school, its first job is to teach students. A not-for-profit hospital, its first job is to make people well. And there is no profit motive in there. And so Switzerland has been successful in delivering very cost-effective health insurance, health care, to its people, because it forbids corporations from operating on a for-profit basis. In fact, there is not a single country in the developed world that will allow a corporation to offer basic primary health insurance on a for-profit basis. There are many that will allow it to offer secondary or tertiary health insurance. For example, a health insurance policy that gets you a private room instead of a duplex, or a health insurance policy that gets you catered food, or a health insurance policy that pays for you if you're outside the nation. Those can be offered by for-profit companies, but the state itself basically pays for the thing. So I'm not totally opposed to that. And what we saw, what we've seen in my lifetime, in the 70s and 80s in particular, was state after state after state. We had all these state insurance laws and state insurance commissioners, and state after state, the states, this did not happen at the federal level, this happened at the state level. The states used to require, all the states used to require, that health insurance companies be not-for-profits. And over time, what has happened is the result of lobbying by these companies, much of that coming out of things like the Buckley decision in the United States Supreme Court in the 70s, was that the states have said, okay, we're going to allow for-profit companies to come into the insurance market and make money on insurance. And now we've got this system where we have our health insurance costs almost twice, and in some cases more than twice, of what it does in any other developed country in the world. And yet we're in the 20th and 30th and 40th, in numerical ranking in terms of outcome, depending on whether you're looking at infant mortality or longevity or quality of care or fill in the blank. And the right-wingers are still running around spewing lies about, well, but we don't have anybody in line. Well, you take 50 million people out of the line gets shorter. We have 50 million people without health insurance. Anyhow, Jim in Alton, Missouri. Hey, Jim, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good. What's on your mind?
Yeah, they're going to do the Supreme Court case on so-called Obamacare next year.
Yeah.
And
we don't know yet, but the Justice Department has asked that the Supreme Court expedite it. The Supreme Court has not responded, but
right.
Presumably they will.
Well, Clarence Thomas's wife has collected upwards of $500,000 from one of the main backers to stop this,
yes,
which of course he lied about on his financial statement.
For over a decade, yes.
Well, I think it was over 6 years.
Yeah, okay.
I was just wondering if you could maybe talk to Bernie Sanders tomorrow and see if he does not recuse himself from this case, if he would be willing to start impeachment process against him.
I would recommend that you call in and ask Bernie that. I generally don't, you know, other than that first 10-minute conversation that Bernie and I have, which is basically Bernie's rant for the day.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to get in on Friday when he's on.
I know it is, and I, you know, it's like we always, the lines are always slammed when he's on there, and he gets to fewer than probably 10 or 12% of the people who call. But that's why I don't ask questions, because I want to leave it up to our listeners. We want this to be a national town hall, not a talk show host talking to a senator. There's plenty of that on the radio and television. And so I would encourage you to just keep trying, and eventually you'll get through and be able to ask him, Jim. It is a very good question. Okay?
Will do, Tom.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening to the program. Let's see here. Peggy in Los Angeles. Hey, Peggy, what's up?
Hi. I've been wondering, why is the Interstate Commerce Committee of the Senate not looking into the voting machines, not doing what they were represented to do? I mean, this is like fraud, misrepresentation, if you can hack into them. And these are being sold and used over state lines.
Yes.
So to me, they would have a valid interest, just like they did back in the civil rights era. That's how we did that, to go in and go after these companies as misrepresenting. And if nothing else, the hearings would let them show that they're hackable, so that people out in the different states using them at least would have somebody showing that they're wrong. We did that here in California with Deborah Bowen a couple of years ago.
And sure. And in fact, we had her on that on our program when she came out, the Secretary of State, and came out and said these voting machines are wrong and they're hackable and we shouldn't be having them. And Deborah Bowen was a real hero for that. And let me give you the very simple, short answer. Democrats are terrified of this issue. And the reason that they're terrified of this issue is that they know that the main way that Republicans win elections is by getting people not to vote. Negative advertising doesn't cause people to vote for the person running the negative ad. It causes people to just not show up.
Can't win if they cheat.
No, I'm totally with you. I'm totally with you. And I disagree with the Democrats on this. But they are afraid that if the word gets out that the vote is unreliable, people won't show up to vote. And, I think it's an irrational fear. I understand the politics of it. I understand the logic of it. I think they're wrong. But you ask why, that's why they're not doing it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with more of your calls and thoughts for the day. What's going on with, Warren Buffett? Should he pay more taxes? We've been talking about the privatization of prisons, privatizing roads, privatizing parking meters, privatizing this, that, and the other thing. What about privatizing education? Cliff Schechter on the line with us, national progressive PR strategist with Libertas LLC, nationally syndicated columnist with Al Jazeera English, contributor over at the Huffington Post, and author of the book The Real McCain. His website, LibertasLLC.com. Hey, Cliff. Cliff? Oh, I got to put him on the phone, don't I? That's my job. Sorry about that. Hey, Cliff.
No worries, Tom. How are you doing? I think my wife wishes she could do that.
Yeah, I forgot to push the button. So anyway, tell me about you wrote this piece, Education Nation or Education Corporation. What's going on?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's what you've been talking about this morning. I like to look at issues and look at the larger culture that surrounds those issues. And the culture, which you speak about a lot on your show, is people don't remember, you know, the way we used to be, when we valued the public commons, when we valued and realized there was something more important than just naked self-interest. So what you see is, like you see with the prisons and postal carriers and others, you know, there's been this sort of assault on education. And I make sure to say in the piece I wrote that, look, there's some good people who work in reform and are trying to reform education in positive ways. But there's no doubt that there are those with interests in destroying public schools. I mean, first, obviously, Christian conservatives have an interest in it. They want to teach people fairy tales about how the earth was, about how, you know, we were created and you know, what science is and what science isn't, and put intelligent design in schools. And so, you know, they have an interest. We saw what happened in Texas with the textbooks creating this fiction for our kids, and obviously that's not going to prepare them to compete in math and science where we're slipping rapidly. But then, of course, a big part of it's corporate. And, you know, there's a number of different tax breaks that corporations could get for investing in infrastructure in privately administered schools, charter schools, and others. By going after unions, obviously, that's always a plus for them. And they can break down, different public sector unions. So, you know, to not look behind the curtain, so to speak, and see that there are interests here aligned. Oh, and a big one I forgot to mention is obviously there are corporations that create these tests and then do the test prep for the test. And there are always these big corporations. So, of course, what are they pushing? 90% testing. I made the point in the piece that there's a guy who I work with, a guy named Dr. Stephen Edwards. There's a group called Edwards Education Services, and they, of course, talk about culture, you know, the culture in schools. Back to that word again. It's not testing. Testing may be 10, 20% of it, but what we need to do is, you know, we need to go into these schools. First of all, we need to spend the money needed in public schools, but we also need to go in and say, look, there are cultural issues. Sometimes you have an African-American student base and the teachers are all white, and there may be communications issues. Sometimes there's confidence issues. You need to work with students so they have the courage to speak up in class. There's all sorts of things that can be done to look at subjective factors, data-driven, not conventional wisdom-driven, and improve schools. But, of course, corporations don't want to hear that.
Cliff, I think that you could argue that there's a continuum, that at one end is the workplace as kingdom, you know, with petty kings being the CEOs and basically serfs as the employees, and in some cases they're brutal and horrible and awful and poorly paid places. And on the other end, or in the middle of the spectrum, is a unionized workplace where there is some balance of the power of capital and the power of management by the power of labor. But there's a third, the other end of that spectrum, of that continuum, that is the far opposite end of the workplace as kingdom, is the workplace as worker-owned cooperative. And I'm wondering if you know of any schools in the United States that have ever been created or run as worker-owned cooperatives, where the teachers and the administrators and everybody working for the school, the janitors, everybody, actually owns a share in the school, and they collectively vote the interests of the school, and they collectively make things happen.
Well, I wish I did. I don't, and that's not to say it hasn't happened. I know that's the model in certain other countries, certain European countries. I think Finland has a model like that. I was just reading something on that. And so I've read that it's a very successful model, and actually you would think, because then everybody is invested in the process of success.
Right.
You know, and that's all we want here, the teachers and students, to act like teachers are people that just are greedy and want big salaries. That's ridiculous, and we all know that was used to try to bust unions. It doesn't mean there aren't bad teachers. It doesn't mean teachers can't get more training, just as students can't be taught, different methods. And I think, in any case, what you're talking about is another way of looking at it, and I think it would have a lot of promise. So I wish we would try that. We're talking about innovation here, but we're only doing innovation in one direction where somebody profits.
Yeah.
I'm not
talking about these as an alternative to public schools. I'm talking about this as an alternative to for-profit or even not-for-profit private schools.
Right. Well, no, and I think it, from what I've read, again, it's a very legitimate model that's used in other countries, and there's no reason why that's not a model we could try here. I can think of a lot of people that would try to get in the way of that because, oh, my God, if that were successful, it's kind of like single-payer health care.
Right.
That's successful, then there's a lot of losers in that equation. We know who they all are.
Right.
But you're right. I think that could be a terrific way of looking at it. Again, it's not to say there aren't ways to reform our system and improve education. And I think there are positive ways to go forward. But starving schools of funding, giving them to these other models, and turning our schools into these, winner takes all, you pass, you do well on the test, or you miss the test, and that's your whole life. That sounds a lot like Wall Street, doesn't it? It's not a real shock that system would be imported, where there's only winners and losers, and there's really nothing in between. And I don't think that would be the best, atmosphere for children to learn in. Teachers teach the test in that atmosphere. Again, testing can be a part of the whole, but it can't be the whole. And that's where I think we're really going wrong right now.
Right. In fact, it seems like a way to go in that direction maybe not even with schools necessarily, would be to simply say, you know, anybody who's worked in this nonprofit for more than a year becomes a member of the board of directors.
I think it'd be a great idea.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of innovative stuff. I've been talking to the folks in Madison at the Union Cab Company. They're, you know, it's a workers-owned co-op, and Isthmus Manufacturing, workers-owned co-op, and
right.
And it's been on my mind a lot. Cliff Schechter at LibertasLLC.com. Thanks, Cliff.
Thanks so much, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Have you ever had any experience with a workers-owned co-op? I'd love to hear from you if you have. And up next, the good, the bad, the insanely ugly, and your calls. That would be the good, the bad, and the very, very anecdotically ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for your brain. The good, Miami Herald columnist Carl Hiaasen, also one of my favorite authors. As Florida Governor Rick Scott and his Republican buddies are forcing welfare recipients to take drug tests, Hiaasen has his own proposal. Force those same lawmakers to take their own drug test. In an interview on MSNBC last night, Hiaasen said, "This is class warfare. This is picking on the folks who happen to be unemployed, especially the ones with children. I say line up all 160 lawmakers for a patriotic whiz fest at the Capitol Clinic. You think more than 2.5% might test positive? Let's find out. And I'll pay for it out of my own pocket. Seriously." Hey, I think it's a great idea. Good on you, Carl. The bad, Anita Perry. With his poll numbers slipping after his incoherent debate performances, Texas Governor Rick Perry has trotted his wife out onto the presidential campaign trail to promote his job creation record. And we're already seeing just how disconnected the Perry family is from middle-class America. While speaking at an event in Iowa, Anita Perry said about the so-called new jobs created in Texas, "I'm not going to tell you they're all high-paying jobs, but they're a job, even if they're a minimum wage job. That's what people are hungry for." People are hungry for minimum wage jobs? Really? According to the Perrys, the American dream is now working for $7 an hour at a dead-end job, sinking in debt, and having to choose between putting food on the table or taking medicine. No wonder people are turning against Rick Perry. Unfortunately, none of the other Republicans are much better. And the very, very ugly Alan West. The Tea Party congressman from Florida is keeping up his one-sided feud with Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Back in July, he called her vile, unprofessional, and despicable, and she has said she did not deserve to be respected as a lady. Well, yesterday, in a radio interview, West piled it on even more. When asked what he thought about Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz, West simply said, "I need a bucket." West then went on to say that he stands by his comments about her back in July. But is anyone really surprised that Alan West continues to act like a sexist seventh grader? After all, he's a favorite of the Tea Party. And that's very, very ugly. Okay, so I went to the, I got curious. My last caller was from Georgia. I lived in Georgia 15 years. I kept hearing these things about Georgia used to be a penal colony, blah, 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 blah. So I went to the internets, the tubes, not the trucks, and, you know, Googled Georgia penal colony. I found a couple of, actually, college websites saying, yes, Georgia was founded as a penal colony. I found others saying, no, it's a myth, with thus the confusion that I continuously was hearing all the years I was in Georgia. And I think the one, it's actually two sentences in the Wikipedia entry, and Wikipedia isn't always all that reliable, but sometimes they, you know, nail it spot on, probably answers both sides of this, just, you know, just to get it out there. And they said English settlement began in the early 1730s after James Oglethorpe, a member of Parliament, that would be the British Parliament, this is the 1730s, this is before the American Revolution, when Britain ruled North America. English settlement began in the early 1730s after James Oglethorpe, a member of Parliament, promoted the area, what we now call Georgia, be colonized with the worthy poor of England to promote an alternative to the overcrowded debtors' prisons. Oglethorpe and other English philanthropists secured a royal charter as the trustees of the colony of Georgia on June 9, 1732. So he wanted to send worthy poor people there before they got so hungry that they stole some bread and ended up in a debtor's prison, apparently. The misconception of Georgia's having been founded as a debtor or penal colony persists due to the numerous English convicts. Now, this is another reason why many people think that it was a penal colony. Due to the numerous English convicts who had been sentenced, this would be by the British courts and the British Parliament, to transportation to Georgia for their punishment. Not for ourselves, but for others, the trustees, with the motto, not for ourselves, but others, the trustees selected colonists for Georgia. On February 12, 1733, the first settlers arrived in the ship Anne at what became the city of Savannah, and that would be the poor of England, who otherwise would have ended up in the debtors' prisons. So, interesting. To the extent that, you know, we know what's going on. What was particularly interesting was to find all the sites, the historical sites, the historian sites, the university sites that were contradicting each other. Go figure. Anyhow, Jim in Leslie, Arkansas. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hey, good evening, Tom. Calling you from the Central Time Zone and UT program.
Uh-huh.
And in your opinion, and looking over all the potential Republican candidates, do you perceive there to be any rhinos or Republican in name only in that group?
I would say they all are rhinos. I think of Republicans, I think of my dad and Dwight Eisenhower. And, none of these guys would have voted for Dwight Eisenhower. Can you imagine any, Dwight Eisenhower in his letter to his brother, Edgar was his name, or maybe it was David, whatever, whichever it was, David, in his letter to his brother in 1954, while he was sitting president of the United States, he said, and I'm paraphrasing from memory, but this is pretty damn close, he said, should any political party argue for the abolition or the destruction of Social Security or labor unions or the social safety net programs like Social Security, that party would never be heard from again. He said, I know that there's a small number of people, principally Texas oil millionaires and a few others who believe this, but their number is small and they are stupid. That's, even Nixon, I think, would have agreed with Dwight Eisenhower on that. So I think that they're all rhinos. Does that make any sense?
Yes. I'm familiar with that, and I can barely recall being at the age of about 7 or 8 that in that years, I guess 1957, that Dwight became president.
Yeah. He became president in 52.
52.
Yeah.
And then I guess there was still talk of and about him, and then also reading about him, in history. And mm-hmm.
Yeah, he left in 60.
Uh-huh. And in later years, and going through some classes, it was kind of presented to the classmates in the little college I attended that it seems to be that war heroes always kind of got into the limelight when they did run for president.
Yeah, yeah. There was an effort, around Douglas MacArthur after World War II, when Dwight Eisenhower came back, both parties were courting him. He decided to go with the Republican Party. Being a member of the military, he had never professed a political allegiance. But here is one of the two slogans. One of the slogans was, I like Ike, in the 1952 election. But the one that I think won him the election was Harry Truman had started this war. Well, I shouldn't say Harry Truman had started. I don't know all the details of the Korean War. But Harry, we were in this Korean War, okay? And it was a mess. And it was a very, very unpopular war. And this was one of the, this is actually a TV ad, and it shows a cartoon character elephant beating a drum with the word peace on it, walking across a cartoon stage, like from the old Disney cartoons. And here's the voiceover that goes along with it.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower, a paid film.
Now, if you wanted your slogan to be vote for peace, vote for, and then fill in the name, the only Republican candidate for whom that would qualify is Ron Paul.
I see. I understand.
And I think,
alrighty, well, I appreciate it. And like you, I've spent an awful lot of time basically my whole life in the southern areas of the United States, such as Louisiana and Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you very much for calling, Jim. It's great to hear from you. And by the way, Ron Paul would not be considered a Republican by Dwight Eisenhower either, because Ron Paul wants to blow up Social Security and do away with Medicare and do away with unemployment insurance and do away with the right to unionize and all those things that Dwight Eisenhower, as a good Republican, felt were really important. George in Kingman, Arizona. Hey, George, what's on your mind?
Yes, hi. You know, the Republicans are very good at using fear to change public policy. Perhaps we could turn that around with the prison, the private prison situation. I live in Kingman, and the adjacent community is Golden Valley. There was a private prison was built here. It was sold to the community as a minimum security prison, you know, DUIs and such.
Right.
Well, it ended up having, I don't know, 180 death murder prisoners. And three of the prisoners ended up breaking out. The MTC, Management Training Corporation, is the company that supposedly ran this fiasco. It was so poorly run, I guess the guards would prop the doors open to add to air circulation and so forth. And the woman pulled up in a car, clipped the fence with bolt cutters. The prisoners got out, escaped, hijacked a truck, went to Oklahoma and killed a Oklahoma couple who were vacationing in their motorhomes. I guess he tried to steal the motorhome. So maybe we could use the idea that private prisons will cause more violence toward, you know, the ones that seem to be insulated by all this crime.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's one half of the story and a tragedy. The other part, though, and this is the equal tragedy, is that there are towns all over America that are so decimated by having had their manufacturing facilities move to Asia or other countries, and people who are so unemployed and so deeply in debt that they'll take any job. And if a private prison company comes to town and says, we're going to hire some people, they're happy to have them there, which is wrong. It's tragic.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But the bigger picture here is that we need to have, as a people and as a nation, a discussion about the commons and the role of government.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Steve in Harrison Township, Michigan. Hey, Steve, you had some thoughts in response to my question about, you know, are there private schools out there that operate basically as co-ops where the at least the people who work there have, you know, board of director status or whatever. You have some thoughts on this or some knowledge
yes,
of it?
I think the Detroit or the Waldorf schools or Rudolf Steiner schools, they go by both names, would fall into that category. I sent my kids through the Detroit Waldorf school, and the teachers were in charge, and it ran quite well.
Right.
And they got a good education.
Do you know it? Go ahead.
My daughter went on to public high school and was a co-valedictorian at her public high school, and teachers always told me, where did she get her education? She's fundamentally sound in everything.
Yeah. And it's interesting because in you're in Harrison Township. In one of the western townships, back when I was writing and speaking a lot on learning disabilities, attention deficit disorder, and education, I was invited by a coalition of Waldorf schools to speak at outside of Detroit in one of the western suburbs on that topic. And, boy, did I meet a bunch of motivated teachers. But I knew nothing about the structure of their institution. You said the teachers run the schools. Do you know more than that? Maybe we need to get somebody from the Waldorf school movement on to find out more about how that's done.
I would think that, but yeah, they were running different parts of it, and they were on the board, and parents were on the board also,
and
one of the unique things with them is a teacher stays with the child from first through eighth grade.
Right. Yeah, that's.
So you don't.
Yeah, you get you keep the same teacher.
Right.
And that is an important thing. In fact, our youngest homeschooled using a Waldorf curriculum, and But that's a whole other story. Anyhow, Steve, thank you for the information and thanks for the tip. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call. Frank in North Hollywood. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You getting better?
I am. So what's on your mind?
Good. Are you aware and are the listeners aware that your stamps.com commercials amount to a participation in a what can be considered a partial privatization of the post office?
A trashing of the post office. Yeah, those ads were pulled, Frank. So, you know, we heard you and probably shouldn't have gone up in the first place, that particular ad. Dawson in Waterville, Maine. Hey, Dawson, what's on your mind?
Hey, not too much. Hey, I just wanted to point out there's a study that was just conducted and finished on September 13th and released. It's by an organization called Project of Government Oversight. They have a website. It's pogo.org, and everybody can see the facts and figures right there. The study concluded they did research on government privatization versus federal employees.
Right.
They concluded that out of 38 sectors of our government, 35 of them are paying 1.83 times more than what it's costing us for the federal employees. And that's on an average of all the entire study, but it's all there with facts and figures on their website. And, you know, it's interesting to see that a nonprofit organization is actually doing the work that the government should be doing, you know, conducting these surveys and whatnot and determining whether or not we're paying more for these, privatization
right.
type things.
You would hope that at least a government that's considering privatizing would do that kind of an analysis. But what's happening is that politicians who are looking for short-term cash to close budget deficits that have been created in large part by right-wing economic policies are just so desperate to get the cash. I mean, every state in the union except Vermont has a constitutional requirement that they have a balanced budget every month. Many cities do, many counties do. And so you've got politicians who are just, you know, What can I do? What can I do? And then, you know, some big corporation comes along and says,
government. They're selling out everything we worked for all these years.
You're right.
And taking the quick payout so they can make their budget look good and they can say, look, I'm a hero. And,
yeah.
and you know, you got to keep going Republican to keep this up. Well, we're not going to have anything left in another couple decades because what's not going to China is going to be sold to everybody across the world. And you know.
Oh, they're aggressively in the process. Bernie Sanders points out we've had 10,000 factories closed in the United States in the last decade, or 50,000 factories, excuse me. So well said, Dawson. Thank you. Dave in Mayetta, Kansas. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. It's good to watch your program. I see this every day. I just retired recently, so I get to see it every day. And it's really a heavy-duty day today listening to what's going on. But I wanted to bring up something a little lighter. I used to live in Portland, Oregon, about the time that you lived there. And I belong to a workers-owned cooperative called Sunflower Recycling.
Mm-hmm.
And we were the oldest worker cooperative recycling company in America, started back in 1971. And we closed our doors in 93 due to waste management coming in and stealing all our garbage customers, which was the way we subsidized and being able to afford to do recycling. That was such a up-and-down market that you could hardly live as a company doing
right.
recycling only at that time.
Right.
And so I didn't know if you were aware of us. We were we knew, you know, practically everybody there was in Portland of any significance in government, and that was friends of ours. And we were highly supported, at least as a progressive community does.
Yeah.
But could not compete with waste management, you know, that multi. We called them organized grime, and they took over our garbage, and that was.
That's always a challenge for any small business, whether it's a worker-owned co-op or just a local entrepreneurial activity. Is when the big boys come in, they can squash you. It's one of the reasons why we need to enforce the Sherman Act. Kevin, thank you thanks for sharing the story with us. Coming up tomorrow, America's Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie.org, by the way. Check out his website. Bernie Sanders will be coming up tomorrow and taking your calls in our Brunch with Bernie Hour. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.